Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Maria Klemperer-Johnson. Klemperer-Johnson is a graduate of Stanford University, where she studied computer science and geology. She worked for several years as a programmer in Seattle, Washington, and soon after arriving in Ithaca, she decided to pursue her passion for working with wood, and in 2002, she got her first job in construction and then went on to learn her trade by working with several regional companies and builders. Encountering few women in the trade, she founded Hammerstone Carpentry for Women in 2013. Hammerstone teaches everything from basic carpentry and workshops to in-depth intensives. They hope to help increase the number of women in the trades. And welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, I want to talk to you about the fact that you started out in programming and in high tech, and you decided to follow your passion of working with wood and building. What instilled that passion in you in the first place?
I remember building ever since I was a kid. I mean, I was always interested in it. I actually just wrote something where I said that I used to build things out of Legos, and my mom had to point out that I didn't actually build out of Legos. My mom had a Lego addiction, and so they were around. I remember inventing creations out of Legos. I was inventing contraptions that would scratch my back, and whether or not I actually implemented them, that's unclear. But I remember thinking about building things, and then as I got older, I, of course, took wood shop in middle school, and I did stuff in my dad's hobbyist wood shop. My grandfather did woodworking, and I did stuff with him. My grandfather had these elaborate German stone building blocks that came in little layers that very precisely laid out. You had to get every stone right back into its exact place, and they had instructions for building cathedrals and monuments. And when I was deemed responsible enough, I was allowed to play with those. So that's an early childhood memory of building, and I love that stuff.
So, I'm surprised you were encouraged to take woodworking in middle school. I guess the times have changed.
Well, yeah, so this is something that's interesting that comes up in a lot of our classes. There are some generations of women who say, I wasn't allowed to take wood shop. And then there's a much younger generation of women who says, well, there just isn't wood shop in my school at all.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I'm from this generation where there still was, you know, art and music and wood shop, and we even had auto shop in my high school. So there still was those types of electives. And yet I'm young enough that women weren't discriminated against in taking those classes. We weren't told we couldn't take those classes.
I see.
I remember in the school that I went to, there was a bit of a cachet for girls to take auto shop. And it was still mostly guys, but there were some women who thought it was cool and interesting to do that kind of stuff.
I wish I had taken auto shop. You know, you and I are both from California, and of course it's Drivingville. Everybody has to drive in California.
Yep.
So it's a worthwhile thing to pursue, I would think.
Right, right.
Now, tell us the first steps you took to pursue this career. And obviously, you got a degree in computers, and you were going to study geology.
Right. So, and thinking back on it, I see a lot of my choices in careers have been leading towards carpentry. So when I decided to study computer science, there was some aspect of building in that. And I look back and I see that that's what I was really attracted to, and that there's like the logic of building and putting things together and, you know, building small components and then building upon those. And what I didn't like about that was that I was indoors all the time. I didn't really like working in the internet industry in Seattle. You know, everybody was there to make a killing, and not because they loved their work. I mean, I know a lot of people did, but a lot of people were there just to make money. And then when I studied geology, I see that I was really drawn to being outdoors more. And so that's what pulled me towards that. And so those are both the things in carpentry that I really enjoy. There's the thinking and building aspect of it, and then there's the outdoors physical aspect of it. But both of those things, you know, computer science and geology, they weren't the whole package.
Yeah.
So when I finally came to carpentry, you know, it was something that fulfilled me as a creative outlet, and it got me outdoors and using both my body and my mind.
Yeah, that's really interesting to me. I hadn't have thought of it that, you know, I wouldn't have thought of it that way. Well, what kind of reception did you get when you started pursuing this and actually trying to gain experience, right? I mean,
yeah, so of course Ithaca is a very progressive community, and everybody who I've worked for in this town has been supportive, has never not offered me a job because I'm a woman, and I've never been the first woman to work on any crew that I've worked on. So I never encountered discrimination in hiring or harassment on the job. I've worked with very supportive employees. employers and very supportive crew members who always treated me as an equal in everything that I did. So I think for me, my biggest obstacle was seeing this career as a legitimate career path. I grew up in a family where we were just sort of, it was expected that we would go to college. And once you're in college, there's a set of careers that are laid out to you upon graduation as sort of legitimate options.
Exactly.
Being a carpenter isn't one of those, right? So, you know, you see like, oh, I could go work in this industry and work for big corporations. Or if you are going to start your own business, it's usually, especially when at Stanford, it's going to be in high tech.
And also teaching. Been a professor.
Yes. Yeah. You could go to graduate school. You could be a professor. You could, work in the government. But this blue-collar work is not, once you start down that path, this blue-collar work isn't seen as legitimate. And in fact, when I dropped out of graduate school at Cornell, my advisor said to me, well, I certainly hope you find something intellectually stimulating. And I feel that I have found that in what I do. I don't think that he would have considered becoming a carpenter to fit into that category of intellectual stimulation.
You know what, Maria? This is exactly what's going on in this culture, though. I mean, we are discouraging people from using their hands and doing this kind of craft, which I also think is art.
Yes.
You know, it's arts and it's a craft that's also artistic. And I think that's why there's so much anger. We're discouraging people from following their heart in some ways.
Mm-hmm. And I think there's lots of divides, of course, in our country. And I don't think people maybe understand how much thinking goes into building. I mean, I feel like every time I'm on a construction job, I'm learning something new every day. The best practices in the science is changing all the time. And if you aren't thinking about these things, you're not going to build a house that performs over time. So there's a lot of thinking that goes into it. But I also think that valuing physical work or hand work has fallen away in our culture, but it's not that different from thinking work. I mean, in any type of job, there are stimulating parts of that job, and then there are incredibly mundane parts of that job. And the same thing is true in, you know, cabinet making and home building. You know, I could spend a day sanding boards, and it was pretty boring, but it gives you a lot of time to think. And, you know, if you're I think of some of my more intellectual jobs that I've had, like programming. I mean, there are days when you're not doing anything interesting. It's just sort of drudgery. And so recognizing that those two sides of things come out in any career is important.
I would think building, you know, what a satisfaction to build something that could last for hundreds of years.
You would hope.
And shelter people and, you know, obviously aesthetically pleasing. You have cabinets and beautiful furniture and stuff. I mean, I think of it that way.
Yeah.
Now, it seems to me that confidence is something that women need to get into this profession, along with some of the other skills, probably some mathematics to be able to measure and some strength. You have to have some strength. But what about that confidence thing?
Yeah, I think that's hard. Not that women aren't confident, but still in our culture, boys are taught these skills when they're young, and girls are a lot less so. Mm-hmm. And so when you get to adulthood, and, you know, for whatever reason you start contemplating a career in carpentry, there are many reasons why you might do so. I think it's a lot easier to cold call a contractor and say, hey, can I get a job on your crew? If you know how to hammer, you know how to measure, you know sort of the lingo, you know what to wear, you know how to act. And as women, we just aren't given those skills growing up. And so that's a big part of what we're doing in our school is teaching women real basics and fundamentals in an atmosphere that recognizes that they maybe didn't pick these skills up as kids. When you're in a mixed environment where there are lots of guys who did learn these skills as kids, they can sort of brush over the learning of those fundamentals and say, oh, this is something that everybody should know how to do just because they learned as a kid.
And they think it's innate.
They think it's innate. There are lots of things that we learn as kids that we learn, and when we look back, we don't remember that process of learning, and so we think of it as innate. And so when you see a whole group of people who have these skills that are seemingly innate, but they're not really, they just learned them when they were younger, it can be hard to try and fail because you haven't had the opportunity to learn those things.
Yeah.
And keep trying.
Too. Absolutely. So let's talk about the founding of Hammerstone,
mm-hmm.
carpentry for women.
Yes.
You said that you decided to start this because you were working in the profession and there's still only 2-3% of women in the profession. So tell us about some of the other philosophy around the founding.
Yeah, so that's the Department of Labor statistic is that fewer than 3% of carpenters are women nationwide. And in Ithaca, it's about the same. Or I actually don't have the statistics for Ithaca, but it feels about the same, if not worse. And like I said, I've never faced harassment or discrimination on any of the job sites that I was on. But after a while, I got tired of being the only woman, always working with men. I also got tired of being seen as exceptional, because there's nothing really all that exceptional about the work that I was doing, except for the fact that I was a woman in this work. And while that feels good at first, after a while it can be tiresome. And the part about being exceptional that's frustrating is that there's a lot of pressure not to fail as a woman in this work.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And if you fail, you're just another tick of proof that women can't do this work, right? So everything that I go into, I think, well, I better not screw this up because I don't want anybody to say, well, look, see, women can't do this work.
Ah, so you feel like a role model for sure.
I feel like a role model.
And kind of a standard if you're the only one there, right?
And there's a lot of pressure, which is exhausting. But what's frustrating is that when you do succeed, it's not seen as evidence that women can do this work. It's seen as, oh, well, Maria's an exceptional woman for doing this work. And to me, the only way that I know that's not true, and the only way for that to change is to see lots of women doing this work.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to a point in my career where I was starting to be bothered by the fact that I was the only woman and thinking about these ideas. And I got to a point where I felt like I had been working long enough that I was at a point where I could share my knowledge. So I started thinking about teaching these classes, but I really needed an impetus to start the school. And so I think it was around January of 2013, a friend approached me about building a tiny house. And she wanted to build it herself, but needed some skills. She did physical work, but she didn't have any carpentry skills. And I said, let's take this opportunity to teach some carpentry classes for women. And it's an opportunity for me to start this school, or at least test the waters on this idea of teaching classes for women. You'll get your house built in the process, and we'll build this community of women working on this really exciting, fun project. We learned a lot that first year about how much we could actually get done in a class. We had 8 women show up for the first 5-day class, and we taught over a series of Saturdays. And in that class, we got the tiny house framed. But the biggest thing that I learned was there was a huge demand for this. So I think we started promoting this class maybe a month before the first class started, and really all I did was hang flyers. And I'm pretty sure that it was my flyer in Green Star that filled the entire course. It was like, and we had a waiting list on that first course.
That is amazing.
So we didn't have to promote it very hard, and it filled instantly, and everybody was so excited. And the people who didn't make it off the wait list were disappointed and had to wait for the next time that we offered something. So based on that experience, I decided that it was something to expand and build upon.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Maria Klemperer Johnson. She is the founder of Hammerstone Carpentry for Women in Trumansburg, New York. Talk to us about what you offer now. You've been in business now for a few years.
Yeah.
Beginning classes, intermediate. Yeah. Do you do one-on-ones?
We do offer one-on-one tutorials. We offer it on our website. It's not something that we get a lot of traction with. We don't promote it very highly, but it's something that we offer. So that is usually most valuable after someone has taken the basic skills class, because then, you know, it doesn't make sense to pay me to sit down one-on-one to teach you the things that you could learn more economically.
And it's much more fun, too.
It's much
more
fun
to work with a group.
And building, there's a lot of community building and shared experience that happens in our classes. What we learned in our first year was to pull out this basic skills building part of our class. I remember as I was theoretically planning our first class where we were going to frame this tiny house, I thought to myself, well, these women are going to need to build some skills. They need to learn how to measure and mark and learn how to cut with first a hands-on, then a
power
circular
tools.
Saw.
Yeah, a few
power tools and hammering and nailing. And I thought, well, building a sawhorse would be a really great way to get those skills, and they'd have something useful to help with the rest of the construction of the house. And I thought, well, we'll spend the first half a day on this project. That building a sawhorse is now my two-day basic skills class. I mean, really, that learning experience fills up a full 2 days, and we usually barely get through
the construction. I can imagine that. There is a lot of skill that goes into building this kind of thing.
Yeah, there's so much. And we spend a lot of time in that class also talking, having like more lecture material. We talk about wood and its properties and wood movement and drying wood and how a tree tells you a lot. You know, a living tree can tell you a lot about how wood behaves and performs. So there's some theory and lecture. We talk about fasteners. We talk about stick framing and some structural considerations.
I assume you also talk about safety.
Safety from the very start. Yeah. We talk about general safety as we introduce each tool. We talk about the safety specifics for that tool and then how those safety principles build and are similar for a wide variety of tools. So, for example, the circular saw, a lot of the safety that you learn around the circular saw then applies to, say, a table saw and a chop saw. But breaking down every single action into its most basic parts, it takes a lot of time and there's a lot to it. And I think people are often surprised about the depth that we go into on all of these things.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah. Now, you were talking about how it's a safe environment to have just an all-woman class. Mm-hmm. To tell us what that means. You know, guys are aggressive, and sometimes they will interrupt, perhaps, and try to take over.
Yeah, it's not really that guys are obnoxious. Like, I don't think that's true. But we, all of us, men and women, have this tendency to fall into these prescribed roles. Mm. And I've observed it. So we do occasionally teach some co-ed classes. I've observed where a husband and wife couple came, and they each had an opportunity to perform a new task. So drilling a hole, they had to drill a straight hole through a fairly large assembly of wood. And the wife tried first and did an adequate job. And then she handed the drill to the husband, and he did a pretty good job. I think she probably did a better job on her first try.
Wow.
And then he handed the drill back to her and said, would you like to do the next hole? And she deferred and said, I'm just going to go pound nails. And the husband took the drill. So this was sort of the more challenging task. The husband took the drill and continued to practice and improve. So it's all of us playing out these roles. It's not that men do something to us. It's that there are these
dynamics.
There are these dynamics, these expectations, and like it or not, we play into them in ways that we don't expect ourselves to, but we do. I mean, I know that I have expectations and thoughts that are completely gendered, even when I'm doing this work and, you know, have a fairly feminist perspective. You know, if I'm referring to a contract, the generic contractor, I usually refer to that person as a he.
Yeah.
So by just taking that out of the equation and having a space where we acknowledge that most of us haven't had a chance to learn these things as kids, and we are starting from the very beginning, and we're acknowledging the process that it takes to learn something, that we're going to try, and we're going to fail, and we're going to pick ourselves up and try again, and we're not in the presence of someone who already has these skills. That makes it a lot easier to learn these things without any pressure.
Yeah, I can understand that. I mean, that's I come from the era when we had consciousness-raising groups, and you know, they were in different genders because it was a safer place to explore stuff.
Right.
And you know, a lot of men are taught to be more assertive.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one of the dynamics that helped us to grow.
Yes. And even in our classes, I mean, it's not just a gendered thing. There are always some people who step forward and take more space and try things more easily. And then there are the more reserved people. I mean, I know that I'm someone who will, out of practice, I just sort of step forward and jump in and try. But as a woman, having been in the situation where men have stepped in front of me, I'm at least conscious that I'm doing that myself. And so I'm more likely to recognize that I'm doing that and actively try to make the space for other women who might be more reserved to take the opportunity to practice.
Yeah. You mentioned also on some of your website material that you sort of mourn the skills that have been lost because it used to be handed down from families, canning and building and, you know, knowing how these skills for survival, right? I mean, so talk to us about that. You must be thrilled that it's kind of coming back around. Small farms, you know, co-ops.
Oh, yeah. I forgot I had written that. I think it's really important that we have these basic skills of survival, really. And it always saddens me to think that the really fundamental skills are the ones that are least valued in our culture, at least when you look at how we pay these workers. So
exactly.
growing our food, creating our clothing, and building our shelters. Like, what could be more fundamental than these things? And, you know, you look at farm wages or seamstress wages and definitely building, you know, you can make a good living in building, but compared to working in the tech industry, you know, it's
or, not... or even being a golfer, a professional golfer. I know that the wage discrepancies in this
yes.
culture just drive me
yeah,
out of my mind.
That's an entirely different conversation. But I at least think that we should, you know, pay for these things that are so fundamental, like really value these things that are so fundamental.
Yeah, yeah. And it's still, it seems crazy to me that women aren't taught this.
Mm-mm.
You know, I mean, still in schools, I thought it was the old-fashioned days. My mother, you know, they were taught homemaking and dressmaking, and but they weren't taught skills like building and repairing and cars.
Right.
And the trades, you know, trade
right.
jobs.
Well, that speaks to a different time in our culture as well, when women were expected to partner with a man for the rest of their life.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah. You know, if you are dividing these skills by gender based on the assumption that there will always be a man and a woman unit leading a household, that kind of works, even though clearly people have their own personal preferences for what type of work they want to do. So now, really, when, you know, we have same-sex couples, we have women who just aren't getting married, it's really important that we
and a lot of men don't have these skills either. I
mean, yes.
I have some men in my life who I probably know more about checking the cars. You know.
I can't remember who I had this conversation with, but someone said that her son went off to college and he was the only one in the dorm who knew how to hang a picture. He knew how to, like, hammer a nail into sheetrock and get a picture hung, and he was the hero because he had just the tiniest bit of, you know, real physical life skills.
God, I mean, that's,
wow.
Oh, isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Now, you also said that you like to use natural materials for your building.
Yeah.
So talk to us about that. Well, what does that even mean?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I was sort of brought up as a carpenter in this tradition of natural building. So most of us are pretty familiar with the term green building. And green building, in my mind, is usually focused on the energy performance of a building over its useful lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
So does it take much energy to heat, really, is the most important thing. But there's a lot that goes in sort of conventional green building. You're not necessarily thinking as much about the materials that go into creating this really high-performance structure. And there are a couple things that I like to consider. Most importantly, the toxicity of the materials. And so that's like, if we're building this really high-performance house, but we're using materials that are potentially toxic to the inhabitants, are toxic to the people building the house, or are toxic in their manufacture to the environment around where they are manufactured, that seems like a trade-off that we're making for this high-performance house. The other thing that I like to think about is the embodied energy of the products that are going into this building. So embodied energy means the amount of energy that goes into producing and transporting these building materials to the construction site. So as a really basic example, we buy local green lumber for a lot of our projects. So we buy it from a mill down in Alpine Junction. It's about an hour away. That lumber is sourced regionally, so probably within a 100-mile radius of that mill, and we truck it a short distance to our site, and it is not kiln-dried. We buy it green, which means it's still wet.
Yeah.
It was basically a tree a short while ago, and we let it air dry, which is
wow.
adequate for a lot of the projects that we're doing. In contrast, you could have lumber that was cut and milled somewhere out in Washington, kiln dried, and so that's an energy intensive process of extracting the moisture from that wood and then trucked across the country to get to this building site. So there's a lot more embodied energy in that conventional lumber that's trucked.
Wow, how interesting. I would never have even thought of any of these things.
Well, and so then once you start thinking about these things, it makes home building a far more complicated process. I mean, you can think about anything. You know, concrete has huge embodied energy, and concrete manufacturing is very polluting. So let's try to minimize the amount of concrete that we use in our houses. Spray foam might be a really excellent way of creating a well-insulated, airtight building that will perform well, but it depends on the petroleum industry. There's a lot of cost, energy, and toxicity costs in the manufacture of spray foam. So is there an insulation material that we could use that performs as well, but that doesn't have all these sort of hidden costs? So some of those materials are blown-in cellulose. That's actually a fairly conventional one. That's just recycled newspaper that's chopped up and dense-packed into your wall cavity. One that I really like working with is straw bale. So, You know, we have local farms that are growing straw, and it's really easy to get straw bales. You stack those as your wall structure, and it provides the insulation and the structure of the wall for very low energy costs.
God, that's amazing. How do you do the research on all this stuff? You must be constantly studying. It's impressive.
Yeah, so I'm leaving tomorrow for a conference. It's called Natural Builders Northeast. I mean, it's a very small sort of ragtag bunch of natural builders. There's a collection of us here in Ithaca. There's some in Vermont. There's some in the Hudson Valley, some in Rochester and the Buffalo area. I mean, there aren't a lot of people doing this work, and it's not very mainstream. So a lot of it is sort of learning from other builders doing similar stuff, having these small gatherings where we trade ideas.
I hope this starts a movement. Maybe you guys are going to start a movement. Now, Maria, before we run out of time, I have to ask you this. I never expected to see this on a builder website. What are bachelorette parties?
Oh, good one. So a couple years ago, I mean, after I had started the school, I was thinking about what are groups of women that might be interested in taking a carpentry class? And it just struck me that, you know, a bachelorette party is this time when you get together with a group of women and you really want to build community. I mean, part of the purpose is to show your support for the bride and to bring friends from disparate areas of the bride's life and bring them together and do something together. And what I see happening in my classes is that friendships are formed. So people who don't even know each other form good friendships as they're creating something together. And, you know, to me, the traditional bachelorette party is just kind of ridiculous. Like, why go out and get drunk and be silly? So why not do something constructive and creative? So we tested the idea last year with a fake bachelorette party. So I had a group of women come and I built a picnic table. So in the bachelorette party, these friends come. We have a lovely meal provided by Iron Owl Kitchen. The friends build a picnic table, which then is a gift for the wedding couple.
Oh, I love it. That is so wonderful.
It's a pretty fun idea, and we're looking forward to having a few of them this summer.
That's so great. Yeah. Well, we are almost out of time. Can you give us some contact information, your website?
Yeah, so our website is www.hammerstoneschool.com. We actually just launched our new online initiative, and that is www.hammerstoneonline.com. And that is where we're trying to extend our reach beyond this geographical area, which is really what limits what we can do. So we get a lot of emails from across the country saying, what is there for me out here in California? So this is one way for us to share our learning, build community, and eventually we're going to start offering online classes.
That's great. Well, thank you so much. I have been speaking with Maria Klemperer Johnson. She is the founder of Hammerstone Carpentry for Women. Thank you so much, and good luck with the future. You're doing some great things.
Thank you very much.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.